A healthy life starts with great sleep. Wake refreshed with Avocado's GOTS-certified organic green mattress, delivering breathable, back-loving support, natural materials from Avocado's own sustainable wool and latex farms, easy financing, a one-year sleep trial, and deep, restorative slumbers. Organic sleep awaits at avocadomattress.com.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, a podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most, because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success.
I've been telling everybody that our government is shady, but every time I do, my family thinks I'm crazy. The hollow earth, UFOs, aliens, and painting, fluoride in the water, they spray our skies daily. When I talk about these things, they think I'm crazy. There's no escaping anymore, the evil that we're facing. Illuminati mind control, they're sacrificing babies. The end of days, but anyways, my family thinks I'm crazy.
What, they don't want to listen to you? They don't want to listen. They don't want to hear it. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with
this is
your
Mark being Mark again.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know? If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You know, start your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
When the Cornbread Mafia was revealed in the summer of 1989 at a press conference in the federal building in Louisville, prosecutors said that they had arrested 70 men from this three-county area in central Kentucky, Marion, Washington, and Nelson counties. 70 men on 30 farms in 10 states with what the government said was 200 tons of cannabis. And that of these 70 men that were arrested, zero of them cooperated in exchange for a lesser sentence. Zero of them were willing to testify that any one of the others were leaders. So the feds had a RICO case, a continuous criminal enterprise case, to run against this whole syndicate to wrap it up and send the people that they accused of being kingpins to prison for life without parole. But the problem is they had no witness. And of the 70 men they had on the record, none of them would be that witness. And so it thwarted that prosecution. Frustrated by that, prosecutors held a press conference, and at that press conference, they labeled this group of guys the Cornbread Mafia. The fascinating part of this wasn't just that it was a big outlaw syndicate, more fascinating that of the 70, none of them talked, and then even more fascinating that of the 70, like 69 of them were Catholic.
And you just heard today's guest, author and investigative journalist, who joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this conversation with James Higdon. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. And joining me today is a very special guest who's talking about a topic with us that is close to home. The audience knows I'm a big stoner, a big proponent of your right to choose what plants you grow on God's green earth. And I think this author agrees. Jim Higdon joins us. He is the author of The Cornbread Mafia, which is a fascinating book all about some good old boys in Kentucky who became America's largest marijuana operation, a homegrown syndicate's code of silence, and the biggest marijuana bust in American history. That's the subtitle, folks. So without further ado, Jim, welcome to the show. How are you today?
And it came from decades of over-enforcement of prohibition. And the Cornbread Mafia is just one aspect of a greater story that we all know pieces of from, you know, usually where, you know, from our native lands, cities, you know, geographies. For us, Kentucky played a large part of it, but it's not a story that's really well known in other places. So it's great to get the word out.
Yeah. Yeah. And you asked me before we started recording how familiar I was and am with the entire saga of this. Not very familiar until finding your book, and I'd love to get into the details with you. So one thing that I really like is at the beginning of the book, you take it all the way back to the earliest history of Marion County and explain how this sort of culture runs strong. It runs deep in this area. So let's start right from the beginning. The Catholics who were persecuted in Maryland, what was their story?
Right. So just to get to where you're going with this question, let me just kind of back up and share with you how I got to asking this particular question, because this isn't what I thought I was writing. I thought I came into this writing a true crime book. Right. And what I ended up writing is basically a cultural history of a Catholic community in rural Kentucky that ends up becoming the culture that cultivated this large cannabis syndicate. When the Cornbread Mafia was revealed in the summer of 1989 at a press conference in the federal building in Louisville, prosecutors said that they had arrested 70 men from this 3-county area in central Kentucky, Marion, Washington, Nelson counties, 70 men on 30 farms in 10 states with what the government said was 200 tons of cannabis. And that of these 70 men that were arrested, zero of them cooperated in exchange for a lesser sentence. Zero of them were willing to testify that any one of the others were leaders. So the feds had a RICO case, a continuous criminal enterprise case, to run against this whole syndicate to wrap it up and send the people that they accused of being kingpins to prison for life without parole. But the problem is they had no witness. And of the 70 men they had on the record, none of them would be that witness. And so it thwarted that prosecution. Frustrated by that, prosecutors held a press conference, and at that press conference labeled this group of guys the Cornbread Mafia. And so it was, you know, the fascinating part of this wasn't just that it was a big outlaw syndicate. More fascinating that of the 70, none of them talked. And then even more fascinating that of the 70, like 69 of them were Catholic. And so why is this the case? Why, like, it wasn't a coincidence that you have 70 white Catholic men from rural Kentucky not talking and cultivating giant outlaw cannabis grows. Like, that's not a coincidence. So as I start looking into the cause and effect relationships that create that scenario, first, I get to prohibition and realize that Marion County was the center of the bourbon industry in the early 20th century. There were 9 active distilleries in a tiny county, and all those distilleries got shuttered. And all of the Catholic men that worked those distilleries all had a dozen kids each, and they had to figure out what to do. And all of it led to either moonshining or bootlegging, or condoning moonshining and bootlegging because it was part of the culture. And then to your question, going back even further than that, like, how does this start? Why is this land settled by Catholics in the late 1780s? And it's because, just like you said, first, Catholics were oppressed in England in the 1630s, leading up to the English Civil War in the 1650s. Catholics are leaving England, and they're going mostly to the colony of Maryland, some to the colony of Rhode Island. But Catholics not welcome other colonies. They're going to the colony of Maryland. It's a Catholic colony. And so the names in the of the people in my community are all on boats coming from England to Maryland in the 1630s, 1640s. And then after the Revolutionary War, all of the English property is seized by the government and then re-granted to veterans of the Revolutionary War and war land grants. And a lot of people from Maryland come to Kentucky. And it starts with Basil Hayden, who is a Catholic pioneer, and he brings his still to Kentucky across the Allegheny Mountains, down the Ohio River. And at the time, typically, settling was happening, you know, on the bigger rivers, the Kentucky River, the Ohio River. But in the 1780s, 1790s, there was still attacks by native tribes, the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Creek, who were not happy with white settlement. And their preferred method of removing white settlement was nighttime ambush by a canoe. So they would paddle up at night and kill everybody in the camp and then paddle away. And so this was such a problem that to prevent that, when Basil Hayden and his Catholic band come into Kentucky, they settle on water, but in the headwaters in the creeks above the river. So they had access to water, but it wasn't navigable because navigable waters weren't safe. So they end up tucked away in the hills, in what we call the Knobs in central Kentucky. And that's where this culture grew. There's a lot of Catholic convents and monasteries dotting the same area where all these distilleries are, and a lot, some of those convents and monasteries are still active today. The Abbey of Gethsemane, the Trappist monastery nearby. Some people might know Thomas Merton, a 20th century Catholic writer. He lived at the Abbey of Gethsemane for years. And then the Sisters of Loretto, their mother house is active and still in Marion County. And the Sisters of Loretto are a very interesting Catholic women's order. They have an NGO, a non-government office in the United Nations building, the headquarters in New York, to focus on nuclear non-proliferation and that sort of thing. Like, they're real socially active nuns, and they're based in that same community. So this Catholic culture that's created the distilling industry, like Maker's Mark Distillery is right there. So Maker's Mark is, you know, key to the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. It's part of the story. And then this Catholic tradition. And then in the midst of Catholic tradition and bourbon tradition, this cannabis tradition emerges.
Right. And one of the key figures in that early bourbon story is Basil Hayden, who settled down there in Marion County and has a bourbon named after him nowadays, right? Is that
going down the Basil Hayden rabbit hole real quick for folks who are bourbon shoppers? Basil Hayden, you're familiar with, is a brand that is made by the Jim Beam family of brands. It's a high rye bourbon brand. And then also the reason why it's Basil Hayden is it's the older aged version of Old Granddad. So Old Granddad on the shelf is the same mash bill as Basil Hayden, just aged 4 years instead of, I think, eight. And Old Granddad is Basil Hayden. So that bust on the front of it, that's where that lineage comes from.
Right. So we have a good understanding, a good basis of the demographic of Marion County and the surrounding area as well. Now, a big shift comes to this population when prohibition hits, right? The alcohol from this area was being shipped all over the country and even to Europe. So it would become, you know, pretty infamous. So when prohibition struck, I imagine that the feds knew, okay, well, we should probably keep our eyes on this area because they're so famous for this distillery, these, you know, Catholics up to no good making all this alcohol in our good Protestant nation. Let's crack down on this. Tell us a story about prohibition, how this sort of changes things up and sets the stage for our cannabis growers.
It turns a good community wild. I mean, one of the things I do early in the book is boil down the headlines that are in the hometown newspaper. And I went through and compared the headlines from the 1920s to the headlines from the 1980s of the same newspaper. And it was remarkable how similar they were, one relative to marijuana, one relative to alcohol. And really it reads like a comic book. Like, it's gunfights and car chases and revenuers like on the running boards of moving vehicles, chasing other vehicles, like gangsters and well-dressed girlfriends coming down from big cities. It gets wild. So one thing that I learned is that during alcohol prohibition, it was illegal to manufacture, transport, or sell alcohol. But the bourbon distilleries had been putting barrels of bourbon in warehouses for years leading up to prohibition. And when prohibition hits, it's not illegal for those barrels of bourbon to exist. It's just illegal to move them. So every summer, they age another summer, and they become more and more valuable, and they're still just sitting there. So criminals are coming and just looting the store. And the methods that they use to steal bourbon from bourbon in the distilleries range from pulling up a tanker, like a tanker truck, and siphoning bourbon out like a barrel at a time through a hose going out of the warehouse, to this elaborate scheme. Okay, so we're familiar with Al Capone in Chicago, but the Al Capone of Cincinnati is a guy named George Remus, like the top dog in the Cincinnati bootlegging scheme. He appears as a secondary character in that Boardwalk Empire series from HBO. But George Remus was Cincinnati's guy. And one thing he did was bought a medicinal warehouse distribution company, a medical product distribution company in Northern Kentucky, and use that to buy medicinal bourbon. Because, like, as a parallel to cannabis, there was a whole thing during Prohibition where a person could get a prescription from a doctor for medicinal bourbon, and pharmacies could sell medicinal bourbon. Old Forester, the iconic brand of bourbon from here in Louisville, was bottled all during Prohibition as medicinal. And George Remus had a permit from a distributor to ship medicinal bourbon, to import it to his warehouse and then distribute it to pharmacies. So he was going to places like Marion County and buying bourbon to bring back to his medical warehouse. And then, because he knew that it was coming and when, he would have it hijacked from his own shipment. He would rob himself and then divert that bourbon into the black market, like up to Chicago or whatever. And there's these just remarkable stories from the newspaper of these gangsters that were coming down with false names, and they figured out, like, they built a garage out of wood, and they had, there was this REO Speedwagon, like this covered, like, station wagon type ride that they parked there. And then they would load it up every night with barrels of bourbon during the day, and they would switch it at night with an identical REO Speedwagon so that no one would notice that it was missing, and drive it back to Cincinnati that way. And then when the gangster and his girlfriend escaped, their car got stuck in the mud. Someone helped them out of the mud. In the process, she left her gloves, like her white gloves, with the person who had helped her, and her actual name was stitched into the embroidery of the gloves. And so police were able to identify the gangster by the name of his girlfriend because she left her gloves, and just wild stuff, like little wild stuff. So it was, you know, and then when I looked at the newspapers from the neighboring towns, like, it would be the same. It was not the same. It was very boring, like farm news and people having heart attacks, not car chases and gangsters from out of town. Like, there was just something like special about these bourbon distilleries and these warehouses, and they were attracting high level criminal interest from around the region.
Right. And again, being a primarily Catholic community, these folks are already sort of predisposed to, you know, sticking together, fending off from maybe outside enemies like the Protestant establishment and other forces that might have taken, you know, exploited them possibly because of their minority position, right? So tell us about some of these moonshiners. Were they all like honest, hardworking men before all this became illegal? You know, did some of these folks who were in the business just sort of give it up because they didn't want to become criminals, and then maybe the criminal element in the neighborhood kind of took over? How did that sort of play out?
I mean, you know, what's remarkable about it being a Catholic community engaged in criminal activity is that there's still some sort of structure and moral center to the community, even though there's a lot of outlaw activity going on. Now, that said, because there's outlaw activity going on, there's no way to enforce that other than, you know, violence or threats of violence. So it's no perfect place. But you nailed it with the, Catholics being a minority group with a Protestant establishment on top of it and surrounding it in every direction. And there was definitely an us versus them mentality that justified a lot of the behavior and the sticking together stuff because, they knew that that was the only way to get through it. It's really interesting, like how this, outlaw activity attracts interest. Like growing up, I heard this story that John Dillinger robbed one of the local banks in 1933, and I just chalked it up to being bullshit because, like it just didn't seem right. But in process of researching the book, it turns out it was exactly right, and everything they said lined up exactly with the Dillinger biography. And Dillinger, when he was locked up in Indiana, was locked up with someone from Marion County who obviously had told him, "Hey, if you need a place to hide out, I got a place for you." And then that's what John Dillinger did in the summer of 1933. He leaves Indiana prison and he comes down to Marion County, and apparently from that hideout, robs two banks in Indiana, two banks in Ohio. And then when he's leaving that safe house to go out for good, he robs the bank on his way out of town. And the local newspaper kind of follows the John Dillinger escapade for the rest of the, I don't know, summer or whatever the timeline is until he's gunned down. But that's the sort of, interest that the local community was generating. And then as we get out of prohibition into the next, say, next generation, next couple of decades, like that span between alcohol prohibition ending and like cannabis cultivation really taking off in the late 60s, early 70s, you still had an outlaw tradition and outlaw operators, career criminals who were stealing from corporations like GE or continuing to moonshine. Like you said earlier, like the feds and the revenuers knew that this was a hotbed for moonshine production, and usually a telltale sign, like how you would find a still is looking for smoke coming from a place where there shouldn't be smoke out in the woods or whatever, because you had to run a fire to heat the still, and that would leave a trail of smoke, and then that's how you would get caught. So these innovators, these innovative moonshiners in the 50s switched to propane gas in like inside of a barn so that they could run a still without creating a smoke trail. And that little innovation managed to keep a very large still secret for a very long time. Like even after alcohol prohibition officially ends, there's still plenty of moonshining and like untaxed whiskey happening, which is another sort of very similar like thing to what we're seeing in the cannabis industry today. Like even though it's getting legalized, there's still an appetite for untaxed illicit product.
Absolutely. Yeah, without saying too much, I myself am not exactly in the green market. Even though it's legal here in my state, I still prefer to go to my old contacts, if you will, who were selling before it all became illegal. And yeah, I think there's still going to be room for a black market, even in states that have gone fully legal. But that's interesting with the moonshining. It's still a crime today for various reasons, whether it's the, percentage of alcohol that you're creating or the tax benefit, doing it outside of the purview of the government. I'm curious though, if you ever came across this thread that dealt with alternative fuel sources, and this is totally out of left field, but we have talked about on the show a few times how one of the possible sort of side benefits of the prohibition went to the automobile industry, which at that point in time, there was a lot of debate over fuel sources for automobiles. And after the prohibition, we moved away from basically ethanol-based fuels, which you could distill at home yourself. And a lot of farmers were doing that to run their tractors and such. And some people conspired against these hardworking men and basically imposed what's now the standard, which is, the oil industry. And yeah, I'm curious if you saw any connections to that and you're looking into prohibition and the distilleries and such.
I'll say that this part of this story is not my expertise necessarily, in that this is not a part of my primary research for the book. And then, certainly, like how cannabis becomes made illegal in 1937 is a part of the story. So I do understand it contextually, just as a, as a preface to me saying, like, I think the primary motivation for outlawing cannabis in the 30s was that alcohol prohibition had ended in 1933 and law enforcement was looking for another product to prohibit in order to manage marginal communities, right? Prohibition, to your point earlier, was largely anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant, as well as racist, anti-Black and anti-minority group. It was easy to use prohibition as a way to control those populations. And then prohibition ended, and law enforcement, federal law enforcement, lacked that element, that tool of population control. And cannabis and marijuana was being seen in cities, brought into cities by, jazz musicians, and influencing the community in that way, and became an easy target for the next round of prohibition. So when it becomes a target for law enforcement for prohibition, then there's plenty of corporate interests who have an interest in going along with that ride. And that includes, to your point, the oil industry. There's also the story of William Randolph Hearst in his paper mills for his newspapers. And so he saw hemp, the hemp paper industry, as a threat to his wood pulp paper interests. So he was along for that ride. And so therefore, hemp and cannabis did not have any real natural defenders when that prohibition went through in 1937. And then was briefly lifted during World War II for hemp for victory for the war effort, which is how hemp gets grown in Marion County for the first time, because historically it was not a hemp growing region. And that only lasted, hemp for victory only lasted for 3 or 4 years, from 1942 to 1946. And then
And
it was prohibited again.
let's expand on that a little bit. And thank you for adding that in, because yeah, it is a matter of, multiple interests sort of putting, maybe they didn't even totally understand the benefit that they were giving to each other, but yeah, the way this system works, they can sort of get behind the right legislators, get behind the right politicians, and, in the long run, benefit their business in spite of other businesses and other potential new industries. And cannabis is definitely a victim of that. But I had never really learned much about this hemp for victory. So cannabis wasn't grown really at all in these regions, but clearly patriotic folks who cared about the war effort and wanted to grow hemp for Uncle Sam. That's how all this hemp got into Marion County. What were people smoking it during that period at all, or was it just thought of as like a ditch weed, kind of like a, to make cord and stuff? Because that's really what it was intentional. Its intention was cord and canvas, right?
Right. So let me start at the beginning, and I'll like it's literally where ditch weed comes from. Like ditch weed, because it grows in the ditch, because it had been grown for cultivation and then stopped, but it's cannabis. So of course, like, it just keeps growing, and it seeds and it grows, right? And so it's growing in fence rows and in ditches after 46, and becomes just kind of a wild plant. And so it's like ditchweed, as its word origin, is like wild hemp after it stopped being legal, right? So, but to get there, when cannabis is made illegal in 1937, the U.S. military is still a huge consumer of hemp rope and hemp, like, canvas. But it's okay to ban it here domestically, because the U.S. military is getting all of its hemp from the Philippines, which was then a U.S. colony. But the Japanese, as soon as they attack Pearl Harbor, immediately attack the Philippines and then take the Philippines. And so, as the U.S. Navy is rebuilding its fleet after Pearl Harbor, it also has to revitalize its domestic hemp supply chain because it's lost it in the Philippines. And that's where Hemp for Victory comes from. And Kentucky and Wisconsin and seven other states, but the two big states are Kentucky and Wisconsin, grew a lot of hemp for the war effort. And Kentucky also grew seeds that the U.S. military, U.S. government, then planted in other places with longer growing seasons. For some reason, it was decided that Kentucky was the only state that that grew hemp for seed. And I interviewed an older man who, as a boy, worked on his family farm as they cultivated Hemp for Victory. And at harvest, they would run the plants through a thresher to get the seeds out. And the kids would operate this machine. And he told me later that after running that machine, they would feel drunk, in his word. They would feel funny. So it certainly wasn't grown for smoking, and the notion of it smoking, of smoking it as a, you know, as a sort of a countercultural thing was unknown to them. But it does also seem to be the case that they realized that there was something to it.
Right.
Even if it was retrospectively. And so,
well, and
how
in,
this
in that ahead. In that scenario, I imagine that, you know, you're growing the cannabis, which is then getting fertile, or you know, it's going through its reproductive cycle, which nowadays we don't grow. You know, if you're smoking cannabis flower, it's a good chance that it's female and it's been kept away from males. So it's not, you know, pollinated, and then the buds grow bigger, stronger, more potent. So, you know, we're dealing with probably like 8-7% THC with this stuff. But still, in those days, I mean, I could imagine you're a farm boy. All you have is, you know, what you can kill and grow around you. Like, you're not numbing your body down with all the chemicals we have today. So maybe they felt that buzz pretty strong from just, you know, coming in contact with the.
And in a culture that where drinking was permissible, right? In a Catholic culture where drinking was fine. And one of the things that separated that community from, you know, the oppressive Protestant overclass above it, which is, you know, the hypocrisy surrounding them pretending like they didn't drink, but then coming to our community to drink, right, or to get liquor to take back. So when the next generation goes off to gets drafted to the Vietnam War, they encounter the cannabis plant in Vietnam as a GI, you know, just trying to get through the war. So like that's where smoking cannabis first hits them. Right. But they recognize that plant as this plant that's been growing wild behind the barn and that their fathers and grandfathers had worked. And they realize what the value of it is to, you know, other GIs from major metropolitan areas, and that all they have to do is grow it and not get caught. And they're from a culture where not getting caught was kind of the thing to do. And, you know, cultivating acres of tobacco or corn or anything else was, you know, was second nature. So they came home and just went to work. So the first time they go out, you know, they've brought seeds back from Asia, and they just, you know, there's no helicopters yet. So all they have to do is hide it from the road. And even if it was from on the road, like in the late 60s, early 70s, cops don't know anything about this yet.
Right. Right. And they're not getting their boots dirty, hiking through the woods, looking for cannabis for sure. So yeah, wow, that's incredible. Now, before the Vietnam era, there was possibly a counterculture element coming through Marion County through the Chitlin circuit, right? So
yeah.
Club Cherry, was it? That was in Marion County. And I imagine some of the jazz guys or rock and roll guys coming through there would have known about smoking weed and probably brought a little bit of that through with them.
That's a fascinating concept. I don't have any reporting of those folks doing that, but you're absolutely right. It would certainly be possible. The performers that play in Lebanon through the 50s and 60s into the 70s is startlingly amazing. And you know, just to go back to the structural reasons why this is, Lebanon, Kentucky is the county seat of Marion County, and it was the terminus of the railroad before the Civil War. So it was the deepest the railroad could get into Kentucky when the war started. And so consequently became strategically important, not just for who controlled the railroad terminus, but also for Black people leaving enslavement deeper in, like deeper from the South and then elsewhere in Kentucky. That railroad spur was a community that was safe and the way out into Louisville and to the Midwest. So there's a Black population in Lebanon that's larger than small towns of its, you know, of its size in the region. And those Black communities are along the railroad. And that railroad gets extended during the Civil War and goes from Lebanon to Knoxville, Knoxville to Atlanta. And so and then north to Chicago. So Lebanon can get musicians coming in on the train from basically, you know, anywhere during the 1950s. And because it's a, you know, a wet county because it's Catholic, then there's bars that serve liquor and has a railroad line that can bring musicians in. And there's enough Black people to support Black nightclubs to see that kind of music, that in 1951, Little Richard is playing at the Club Cherry. And again, one of these stories that you hear as a kid that sound outrageous until you realize that it might be true. The woman who ran Club Cherry was named Lucille Edlin. And the local story is that Little Richard's Lucille is named after Lucille Edlin. And he records Lucille in like 1953. So, you know, like the timeline checks out. Jimi Hendrix comes through like before he ends up in New York. He was stationed in Fort Campbell in Kentucky and then drops out of the army, ends up in Nashville touring regionally. So again, you hear stories of Jimi Hendrix coming through. Sounds like bullshit, but then you check the Jimi Hendrix biography and it lines up. Otis Redding played twice, and then Ike and Tina Turner played a dozen times at least. They had a relationship with the bar owner, a guy named Haileem George, who was a Lebanese immigrant or a first-generation Lebanese American. And he and his family had settled in Lebanon, Kentucky, and he became mayor and was a nightclub owner and would bring in Ike and Tina on a regular basis. And, you know, like, I grew up in a community where my parents and my parents' peers would talk about going to see Ike and Tina on weekends and how great of a time they had. And then, you know, we grew up in a small town that had been, you know, kind of homogenized by then. It had none of that fun stuff and basically just, you know, like pissed us off that our parents had a good time and we got left with nothing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And your parents' generation would have been the same or maybe earlier generation to this group of guys that became known as the Cornbread Mafia?
The exact same generation, like same high school graduating class.
Wow. Okay. And I imagine with a story like this, like as a journalist piecing this together and there's this code of silence, like you got to be a member of the community or have some pretty deep contacts to be able to get some of these stories out of guys who can now talk about this, right? So let's get into that era that your parents grew up in and how the Cornbread Mafia sort of formed, because yeah, these guys, as you were alluding to earlier, were in that Vietnam era. A lot of them were either, you know, new vets who were coming back or were themselves vets coming back and yeah, brought this knowledge of cannabis and its money-making potential and its, yeah, smoking it, I'm sure was probably another interest of theirs, but let's get into that.
Yeah. I mean, it started really quick and, you know, family groups, brothers and cousins and uncles and nephews, like, you know, joining together to tackle different parts of the supply chain, you know, cultivation, distribution. And these veterans, when they came back, not only did they come back with the knowledge of the value, but also with an instant, like, nationwide network of interested parties in different places, you know, so they instantly knew people in Los Angeles and New Orleans and Miami, and they could, you know, like, they could move a lot of product. And the first major development, once they get, you know, like, you know, cultivation and distribution under their belts, is they move a bunch of product after harvest, you know, all like, you know, outdoor cultivation. And the people they're selling to are like, okay, great. You know, we'll be back for more in a couple of months or whatever. And these Kentucky guys are like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Like, we're not going to have any more until we grow it again, and we're not going to have a harvest again until like November, and we're going to dry it, and like it's not going to be ready until, you know, December, January. And these buyers are like, I don't care what you're saying, I'm going to be back in 2 months, and you need to have more. And that pushed the growers, they had mastered outdoor cultivation and outdoor product distribution, but they had to also become smugglers to fill in the off season, because they were selling at such a high level that they had buyers who were expecting it regularly. And so that led these country boys into the Caribbean, into Central and South America, growing, cultivating, and smuggling large amounts of cannabis back into the States. I track one case that was public record that involved a shrimping boats from the coast of Georgia, a community outside of Savannah, Georgia, called Thunderbolt. And Thunderbolt, Georgia is another outlaw town. And the flavor of Thunderbolt, Georgia is that it's a shrimping community. And during the Carter administration, there was a collapse in the South Carolina shrimp economy. The federal government called for a moratorium on shrimping. And that led these communities with, you know, mortgages on these boats that they couldn't pay. And so a lot of those boats got diverted into, you know, extracurricular activity, like driving it all the way down to the Colombian coast and getting an entire shipment of cannabis and then bringing it back. And then it would act as a mothership, and they would send little smaller boats out to do transport back onto shore, and then from shore move it from Florida back into Kentucky by truck. Like, it was a complicated, dangerous procedure, but that's what these guys had to start doing to fill in the cannabis supply in their off season.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors. First and foremost, our newest sponsor, Vibe Med X. And my man Ron has finally joined me on the podcast. That episode will be coming out this week, where you can learn all about Shilajit and its nutritional, wonderful, healing qualities. I'm telling you, folks, Shilajit is the shit. Okay, promo code CRAZY at vibemedx.com and learn more about what Shilajit can do for you. They say it's the fountain of youth, and I believe them, because I've been taking it and it works wonders. Shilajit today, vibemedx.com/crazy. Next up, we got to stay above. We got to go beyond. We got to get away from all of this big tech oversight. And you're probably wondering, well, all these companies are pretty much working in cahoots, what can I do? Well, you're in luck. Above Phone is here to help with their phones, tablets, and laptops, which are all designed to be 100% transparent, private, and allow the utmost digital security. Whether you're browsing the web, texting, calling, or using apps, Above Phone has got your back with a completely different operating system. It's the same phone, same laptop, hard body that you know. It's the same hardware, but they've changed the software so that you can use this graphene operating system, this entirely different operating system that basically keeps you from being spied on. So go figure. No wonder why they're only advertising on podcasts, because the big tech companies don't want you to know about Above Phone. So go to abovephone.com, use the promo code CRAZY at checkout to support the show, and save when you're picking up your Above Phone tablet or laptop to stay above and beyond. And last but not least, Brain Supreme. I'm telling you, folks, I love Brain Supreme. I took a little bit of it last night. Had some interesting dreams. I don't know if that's related at all, but microdosing is something that you can do. If you don't know why, look it up. I don't have time to explain it, but it's incredible that we have this available to us today in this modern world. So go and check it out while the offer still lasts. Promo code CRAZY at brainsupreme.co. My man Adam has got a whopping 15% off if you use that promo code CRAZY at checkout. and save with your new microdosing regimen. Learn more about microdosing at brainsupreme.co. And don't forget to use the promo code CRAZY. All right, let's get back to this episode. We'll be right back after this quick break to our dynamic ads. Thank you again for tuning in. Remember, I need your support. We're going to start really reining things in to get people to sign up on the Patreon. So you want to get there while the $2 spots are still available. That's all I'll say. Patreon.com/MFTIC. Great things on the way. Spring has finally sprung and Hims is here to help you men spring into action this season in the bedroom. That's right, Hims has changed men's healthcare by providing you with access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Okay, don't deal with ED and all the discomfort associated with it alone. ED is not your friend, but Hims is now, and they've got your back. Hims provides a range of doctor-trusted ED treatments like chewable tablets, Viagra, and Cialis, and their generics for up to 95% less. The process is 100% online. Just fill out an intake form on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free. No insurance needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. So start your free online visit today at hims.com/crazy. That's hims.com/crazy. HIMS.com/crazy for your personalized ED treatments. hims.com/crazy.
The featured products include compounded products which are not approved nor verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality by the FDA. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information. Prices vary based on product and subscription plan.
Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you about my favorite new sponsor. That's Mood. I love Mood because they're providing affordable, accessible, convenient, and transparent cannabis that's 100% legal and grown on small, pesticide-free American farms. That's right, American cannabis for American listeners. And it's 100% legal. They've got a full selection of cannabis products. I was a huge fan of their Tangy flower. Wow, it really brought me back to when I had first tried Tangy, and it was incredible. So if you have any doubts, try Mood for yourself, and I doubt you'll be disappointed. Use the promo code CRAZY and get 20% off your first order at mood.com. That's 100% federally legal cannabis, pesticide-free, delivered directly to your front door in a discreet package. Mood.com, promo code CRAZY, and trust me, folks, you're going to love this stuff. I give it the Mystic Mark guarantee. And Mood is going to back that up because not only do they stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you get 20% off your first order with promo code CRAZY.
When was the last time you refreshed your bedding? Sleep cooler with Avocado's naturally breathable, certified organic sheets. Choose from GOTS certified organic cotton, linen, or hemp, all made safe certified to the highest standards of non-toxic safety, delivering the ultimate in luxury, sustainability, and style. And a deeper, more restorative sleep. Join Avocado's mission to be one of the world's most sustainable brands at avocadomattress.com.
They were making contacts in other countries, shipping it in. And as far as you know, because when I hear Colombia, I'm not thinking cannabis, I'm thinking cocaine. Were there other drugs involved? You know, was there some sort of moral code that kept them to just cannabis, or maybe cannabis was easier than other drugs? What's the story there?
So there becomes a split in this group along this moral code. Some in this group ascribed to a moral code of cannabis only and saw the dangers of cocaine, and others in this group fell right into smuggling cocaine by the kilo straight from the jungle right into the heart of Kentucky. And what's interesting, I don't know if we call it a conspiracy theory, but a possibility that I don't hear talked about much in the drug war history, is that in 1979, there was a collapse of the Colombian cannabis market. That there had been a lot of cannabis grown in Colombia in the 70s. And then when these guys brought a shipment from 1979 of Colombian cannabis, it was terrible and no one wanted it. And it clogged up the system because it just wouldn't move, hollowed out the supply chain. And then coincidentally, that's about when cocaine fills that same supply chain. So there is a question of whether the 1979 Colombian cannabis harvest was intentionally sabotaged in order to make way for cocaine trafficking. You know, so that's, you know, but whether it was causative, it was certainly correlative that those two things happened.
Yeah, that's interesting. And we all know there are dangers to both, but one of them is obviously much safer than the other. And yeah, cocaine is a hell of a drug that really destroys communities, especially moving ahead into the crack era. But that's a little too far ahead. Now, when it comes to the Cornbread Mafia, these guys, they're growing it, they're selling it. Are they smoking it? Does a cannabis culture sort of blossom in Marion County, hippies and such, or is it a little bit different because it's the South and people aren't as maybe open to that kind of stuff? What's the deal in this part of Kentucky?
There's some diversity in this part of Kentucky regarding this. So, you know, like there's definitely a cannabis smoking culture that emerges from the local country boys. So that does make them, you know, sort of more relatable to broader cannabis subcultures of the time, but still just sort of distinctly Southern. Although at the same time, there's quite a bit of back to the land hippie development, like, you know, hippies moving in to Marion County. And I think completely coincidentally, hippie families coming in and realizing, oh, we've accidentally stumbled into a giant marijuana hotbed and became customers or constituents of that culture. But to my knowledge, the inbound hippies didn't really get into a production relationship because of the tight-knit nature of that cultivation culture. It was still always locals.
And now they were growing it, so it doesn't sound like they were selling it much beyond if they're not, you know, making production relationships with the new hippies. It sounds like they're shipping it to other places for it to be smoked, like the big cities, New York City, Miami.
Yeah, it was still ubiquitous. Like, just for context, when I was a high schooler and, you know, like feeling kind of punk rock, to differentiate myself from my peers, I did not smoke cannabis until I got out of high school because it was so ubiquitous that to be different and to rebel was to not smoke pot. Mm. So that's, you know, like, and that was, you know, early 90s. By the early 90s, it was basically everywhere. And, you know, like high school football games, it would smell like it. You know, just it was a, you know, and parents in the media were telling us it was bad, but the context around us was that it was just, you know, sort of take it for granted.
Right. So very open season use policy. That's interesting. There was sort of a straight edge group of people when I was in high school, even, and this was, you know, late 2000s. But yeah, I had a similar instinct when I was a kid to be like, nah, this stuff is, everybody's doing it. I'm not into it. You know, it wasn't until after high school that I really sort of dove head first. But yeah, it's interesting, you know, because from growing up in Connecticut in the North, the sort of stereotype that we get of the South is not pot. It's alcohol and hillbillies, you know. So this is all very elucidating for me and kind of opened my eyes a little bit more to this group of people. Now, when it comes to the distribution, it was something like 10 different states the Cornbread Mafia was connected to. How did they grow beyond Marion County? Obviously, they had connections from being vets and knowing people through that network, but how did they begin to, you know, move in way up to like Wisconsin? Because some of these guys, they ended up fleeing to the Great Lakes when the eye of the law came down on them, right?
Right. So just for clarity, the 10 states that get busted in aren't related to distribution. That's cultivation.
Okay.
And the reason why they're cultivating, the reason why these Kentucky guys are cultivating in like Minnesota, Nebraska,
right,
Kansas, Missouri, you know, on and on, almost, you know, like all mid, like north and west of Kentucky, although Ohio, was because they were running from the helicopters. So when the helicopters start flying in Kentucky, the first place the Kentucky State Police flies a helicopter is over Marion County, and I think the summer of 1982. And in one weekend, identify 45 acres of cannabis. Right. And so that's the last year that cannabis gets grown at that scale in Marion County. Those growers are growing it in other counties. And then as the Kentucky State Police helicopter program moves into other counties, it's pushing them into other states. And they're going as, you know, as far away as they can, as into as remote areas as they can, hoping to avoid the helicopters.
Wow. So then it's just a mad dash to go as far and as far away from civilization as possible, I'd imagine. Anywhere that you would guess that a helicopter wouldn't end up.
I found some police records from this Missouri state trooper who'd been tracking a bunch of them in Missouri. And he found a farm that was just for heavy equipment. It was like a way station farm that they kept clean. Like, it wasn't a dirty farm. They were using it for moving stuff in and out because they had so many farms in the one area and equipment that was servicing all the farms. They kept one farm clean just to move equipment in and out of.
Right.
Like that's the scale they had gotten to.
Wow. So when these farms start getting busted by the helicopters, how does this affect the Cornbread Mafia? Because obviously these guys are keeping their mouth shut as far as, you know, snitching on each other and whatnot. So when does the law really kind of piece this together that all these different growers are working together?
I did Freedom of Information Act requests with the FBI and the DEA and got back these amazing documents, one of which was this list, like an outline list in like alphabetical order of all of the busts that they were piecing together. So I just imagine like a bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., somewhere in the Justice Department, like slowly dawning on this guy that like all of these cases are connected and no one knows anything about it. And he is like the sole keeper of like understanding how big this network is. And he's typing it up in a report listing all of these different busts, like this bust in this state with this many cannabis plants and this many people arrested, all from Marion County, Kentucky. And they're just listing them one by one, by one, by one, until finally they put together a task force, a federal task force, FBI, DEA, IRS, Kentucky State Police. And that's the task force in the 80s that begins to piece all this together. And they think they've got a RICO case, a continuous criminal enterprise case. But this code of silence that you talk about thwarts it.
Now, Jimmy Bickett, mm-hmm. He's one of the main guys. Johnny Boone is another main guy, right?
Yeah.
When these guys start getting caught, what what happens to the rest of the Cornbread Mafia? Like, does it sort of fall apart? I mean, how does this sort of all come to a close for these guys? Because there was a moment where some people started getting killed over this, right? Does this sort of occur because of the pressure that's being put on the mafia?
I mean, I think the violence starts happening because of the cocaine. And cocaine's what makes things go completely kind of off the rails. And those old sort of outlaw traditions, the Catholic outlaw traditions that were kind of holding things together in a close-knit way, that all that gets blown apart with cocaine. So, I mean, that's sort of the first villain of the story is cocaine. And then Johnny Boone and his group get arrested up in like upper Minnesota, like way up in northern Minnesota. And there's 20 guys up there with a farm that that authorities say is 90 tons of cannabis when they estimate it. And then they haven't, like, they've yet, by the beginning of 1989, they have not yet arrested anyone inside of Marion County. Everyone that they've arrested and associated with this Marion County cannabis cartel, they've all arrested other places, other states, some in other places in Kentucky, but not anything in their home turf, because it's just too airtight of a community for them to do that. So the feds go after the Bickett brothers hard and jump on them with both feet, bring a confidential informant in from Maine, wire this guy up from Maine who is sitting in federal custody on another charge, and they realize that he has bought from Marion County in the past, and so they send him back down wearing a wire expressly, not just to bust the Bickets, but to bust the Cornbread Mafia on their home turf, to let them know that they can get them where they live. Because up until that point, it had been impenetrable. And so the Bickets got the worst of it, because by that point, this task force was, you know, personally invested and felt disrespected by how successful these Kentucky guys had been. So that's what led up to this press conference in 1989, where all that got revealed. The Bickets were arrested in February of 89. And then that press conference was July, I think, or June. So it wasn't long after where they decided to wrap it up. Now, the result of that was it created a vacuum, and that vacuum was filled by other people, and other people who, you know, were more violent and you know, had even, you know, less regard for human life than the guys that got removed from the game board. So it just perpetuated the cycle and caused more police corruption and, you know, more bad stuff, as prohibition does.
And that's, these guys, they're sort of the second generation of growers. There was a first generation before them that had a guy named Garland Russell involved, and he was pretty violent too, right?
Yeah, he was the quintessential sort of stone cold criminal that gets associated with this sort of stuff. He's, you know, he grew up nearby. I found some fascinating old police files on him, and he was, you know, genuinely violent and frightening. And the guys in the business, you know, like, their options were have Garland on your team or on the opposing team, and they would just keep him in the fold because it was easier to deal with them that way than the other way. And then Garland Russell disappears one day for good forever, and no one's ever known what happened to Garland Russell. And just kind of one of those things. He lived by the sword, and he appears to have died by the sword, although no one knows for sure.
Wow. Yeah, very strange. A lot of strange characters in this saga. But Johnny Boone, he becomes known by a different name, and he's also connected to some Mennonites in Belize. What's going on with this little segment of the story?
This little segment of the story. So again, we talked about these guys, country boys, having to dust off a passport and figure stuff out other places. And Johnny seems to have figured out something in Belize. And, you know, Belize is unique in that it's an English-speaking country in Central America. And he goes down there and find some farmland. There's a lot of things about the Belize connection that I was not able to report because as a journalist, I didn't have it checked out. It wasn't, I don't have documents to prove what I feel like I know about that whole Belize thing, but it involves a lot of, Johnny wasn't down there on his own. He had a lot of help in a place like Belize. But when he's down there in a foreign country, looking around in the jungle, trying to figure things out, he sees Mennonite farmers tilling the land, and like looking like they're from the Pennsylvania Dutch. And so to a country boy like Johnny Boone, that's something that's familiar and from home. And he was able to talk to those guys and get his bearings down there and able to, secure, a significant connection out of Belize. He's busted meeting a plane coming back from Belize in like the winter of 1982. So to give you a time frame on that, his Belize adventure ends in 1982, which means it began, some years before that.
Wow. So how far do these guys get as far as infamy goes? Like, are they sort of hometown heroes? Are they sort of, do they build a reputation for themselves while they're, at the height of this?
To my knowledge, everyone who did time with Cornbread has returned home, at least the first wave of them, including some people who had life in prison without parole that President Obama commuted sentences of. And everyone who comes back is welcomed back into the community. They're volunteering, they're working, they're members of the community. And they haven't been ostracized or looked down upon. They've been welcomed home.
Yeah.
So, our community did a really good job repatriating these guys back into the fold.
Hmm. Well, and it seems like, the ones that kept to that moral code had every right to be a part of the community. It's like, this is the cloth they were cut from. This community is outlaw. So to take part in this culture was not something that would have ostracized them. It's sort of what made this community.
Right. And there's the other side of that's the other side of the community is, often concerned that these stories bring a bad reputation to the community, make economic development in these communities more difficult, makes it more difficult to bring in factories and other sorts of investments. But over time, and with the publication of my book and with a better understanding of how this part of the culture integrates into the broader culture, it's, value add. People see it as, a interesting and fun part of this part of the state.
Yeah. So let's get into some of these characters. I'm sure you've gotten to know some of them. What was it like talking to these guys, after and getting some of their stories? Because I'm sure there's plenty you learned from them that wasn't available in, police archive or newspaper report. What were some of those stories?
Well, the first part of this was just breaking the ice, because for 20 years, none of these guys had talked, and other people had tried to do what I ended up doing. Other people tried to get this story out of them, and no one had been successful. And the fact that they knew who my parents were was helpful, but still not getting the deal done. And so what I had to do, really lean on my training from the Columbia University Journalism School, go into the courtroom, the court archives, dig up all these archival records, go through trials and sentencing hearings and get the government side of these stories. And then I go back to these guys and say, so in the sentencing hearing, this is what, this is what it says about your case. And a guy would say, well, that's bullshit. That's a lie. That's not how that went. And I'm like, I get it. I know. I hear you. I don't believe it either. But if you don't talk to me, this is what I've got. And if you don't talk to me, this is what I'm going to run with. And I know that's not the full story or even accurate. But if no one tells me what is accurate, I don't know it. And so using that method, able to get folks who are unwilling to cooperate, at least to cooperate enough. With Johnny Boone, he and I had an agreement that he wasn't telling me anything new. He wasn't telling me anything that I didn't know. I had to bring Johnny documents and say, this is what I've got. And then he would help me understand what I had. And I don't think he rarely told me things that I didn't already have a piece of. You know, so that's how, you know, like what I was able to string through the book and a cause and effect relationship from beginning to end is kind of thin in some spots, thinner than I would like it to be, because guys weren't volunteering stuff to me. Even when I had relationships with them, they were only helping me understand what I was bringing to them.
Now, they didn't want to give any of this up for fear of breaking this sort of code, or is there the chance that they could maybe criminal, you know, give up something that could indict them? I mean, obviously these guys have already served prison time. So is it just the code of silence?
Right. I mean, think about the fact that, like, you know, 70 of these guys got busted. None of them talked. By not talking, they preserved a substantial number of other people from going to prison.
Right.
Or from those people from surrendering the property that they purchased from funds that might not have been, you know, accumulated lawfully. And in telling stories about what happened, it wouldn't take too long for that to include someone who had not yet been adjudicated. And that wasn't something that anyone was interested in doing. And, you know, when writing the book, I wasn't interested in getting new people in trouble. That wasn't the point of my book. The point of my book was to tell the story as it happened through the perspective of the people who got processed by the justice system. I wasn't trying to get new people caught. But sometimes those stories involved people who hadn't been caught. And so consequently, it made it difficult for them to tell me what happened, because they didn't want me, you know, on purpose or accident, revealing other people who hadn't been scooped up by the government already. And it just doesn't take long to tell a story before it involves someone who didn't get caught.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, there is a character who, you know, I guess the timing is a little few years late, but maybe 4 or 5 years ago, people would have seen the synchronicity here. But there's a sort of Tiger King amongst the Cornbread Mafia. This guy who bought a lion cub, Johnny, or Jimmy was the guy, the cat person.
Oh, yeah. Jimmy had a lion. Jimmy Bickett had a lion. Bobby Joe Shoemaker had lions, plural.
Oh, wow.
They, the state police of Kansas, bust this operation out in Kansas, and they just missed Bobby Joe Shoemaker, who's growing cannabis in Kansas while also a federal fugitive. Like, he already has skirted a federal conviction, and he's still out. I mean, among these guys, Bobby Joe Shoemaker is the most incredible of them. Like, his story is pretty amazing. And he leaves behind this crime scene, 2 lion cubs and a bear. The bears had been defanged and declawed, so they can't repatriate it anywhere. So it ends up on a nature preserve. The lion cubs get taken into custody by the Topeka, Kansas Zoo. And even then, back in the 80s, the National Zoo System had an adoption service, and you can't introduce lion cubs into an existing pride. So they put them up for adoption. The Houston Zoo takes these 2 lion cubs. So when I'm reporting this book at the beginning of 2006, I'm looking for these lion cubs. And in the Houston Chronicle, like the front page of the Metro section of the Houston Chronicle, back when newspapers were a thing, they ran the obituary for Bruno, the lion that had been the centerpiece of the Houston Zoo big cat exhibit for the last 20 years. And Bruno had come to the zoo from a drug bust in Kansas. And Bruno's sister was still alive down there. And I drove to Houston and went to go talk to the big cat vets and met Bruno's sister and Bruno's daughter in the big cat exhibit, and, you know, talked to the big cat keepers about, you know, how those cats had, you know, been sort of, I don't know, like citizens of the zoo and parts of people's, you know, parts of the community for 20 years. But they all came back to Cornbread Mafia busts. And so, and the lion and that Jimmy kept was also like of the same lions. And the DEA at one point thinks that they can arrest Jimmy and connect him to the Bobby Joe Shoemaker bust because they both had lions. Like, the lion was a witness. Like, that's how how desperate some of these federal law enforcement people got because of like what little they had to go on. They knew things were true, but could not get it. And so we're going after the lions. Like, you mentioned you're in Connecticut. I went to school at Brown for a couple of years and would talk about these things with my classmates who, like you, had never seen, anyone from Kentucky. I was, like
A
a
foreigner.
curiosity to them.
Yeah.
I was like a cartoon character, like a talking dog. Like they just didn't know what to do. And then I would talk about Cornbread Mafia stuff and these lions, like well before I even had thought I could write a nonfiction book about them. And they were like, wait a minute, what? And I'm like, yeah, we had lions. Your weed dealers don't have lions.
Oh my God. Well, and that kind of begs the question, was this just for the exotic allure, or were these lions playing a role on the farm somehow? Maybe like a sort of threat to any would-be criminal enemy coming to rob their farm, or
I mean, it's a little bit of all of this, like, just sort of like bravado, projected masculinity, like, but also just like not giving a shit and enjoying themselves and having a good time and like having like, just a lot of cash and interesting connections and, things happen. Like you acquire some lions because someone's got them and you got cash and yeah, you want a lion? Who doesn't want a lion? So, like there weren't a lot of guardrails for these guys at a certain point. Like it was just, it was whatever.
Yeah, this black market trade, you sort of get to know some unsavory characters. And yeah, I'm sure the illicit animal trade is right in there with the drug trade. I mean, they're probably sharing space on the boats then shipping these things over. But yeah, that's fascinating.
My guess is Miami, but who knows?
Yeah, interesting. Well, it's good to know the origin of was it the Cincinnati Zoo or the Houston Zoo? Houston
Houston.
Zoo. The Houston Zoo's lion pride. That's interesting. I wonder how many zoos have a connection to the drug trade in that way. There's all the talk about Escobar's hippos and how they have basically, he introduced an old world species to South America, possibly forever now, because hippos are very well suited for the Amazon. So it's only a matter of time before they just proliferate.
That's wild. Luckily, there wasn't any sort of invasive nature of these guys. That was just, sort of,
Well,
onesies.
depending on who you ask, there may be a latent population of hyenas in North America that are very much brought over by people practice, trading in the illicit animal trade. And what's strange about this is in Africa, because there's so many big predators, a hyena becomes a pack animal. But in North America, where there are so few large mammals, hyenas actually fit more into the range of like a stealth, like a panther almost. So there are biologists who theorize that there are hyenas in North America, but they often get mistaken for large wolves or coyotes or something like that, because we're just so, not used to seeing a creature like that. When hyenas, I think they're actually closer related to like skunks than they are dogs. They're not actually canines. So yeah, it is interesting to see how, these circles connect in this really strange way. But I gotta ask, because I'm obviously a Yankee and not familiar with the lingo, but how did this term cornbread mafia come about? What is cornbread, a nickname for cannabis in the South, or is there something more to this cornbread name?
No, it's more of a cultural signifier, as a way to distinguish, this organized crime group from really from Italian and urban, urban ethnic organized crime, which is, in the early 80s is what we're talking about most common, like the Godfather movies, like, even before Goodfellas comes out, this notion of organized crime, but not Italian urban organized crime, but rather, this country southern variety of it, and cornbread as a sort of cultural signifier of that distinction.
I've not had the pleasure of a Southern meal, so I'm missing out big time, because if I had, I probably would have known that. So yeah, that's a good point to make. And the Italian mafia, for that matter, had a lot of respect for these guys when they did eventually serve prison time, to the point where Johnny Boone learned about their what they call omerta and got that tattooed on his back, correct?
Yeah, nailed it. You know, peak of the drug war, Johnny gets busted in this 90-ton bust up in Minnesota in late 1987. So, like, you know, peak Reagan era drug war stuff. And so he's sent to the federal maximum security prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is, you know, one of the worst places on earth. And the way he tells it, he was immediately sent into to be the cellmate of a guy named Joe Testa. Joe Testa was a New York Italian mafia hitman operating out of Brooklyn as a half of a two-man team that was referred to as the Murder Machine, different from Murder, Inc. These two guys, Joe Testa and his partner, were operating out of a bar in Bushwick. People came in the bar on the front end, went into the back room, and never came out. And he worked for two different families. Off the top of my head, I forget, the Bonanno, then the Genovese, something like that, and ends up in the federal prison for assassinating a federal witness at the courthouse, like getting pulled in by a armed guard into the back of the courthouse. And Joe Testa comes up along the sedan with a pistol and executes a guy on the spot. So ends up in federal prison and then harassed by the warden. And Johnny, in the scenario, gets put in as a cellmate while Joe Testa is in solitary confinement. And the warden has sent three inmates to clean out a cell. And Johnny, out of just his personal integrity, refuses to let these three dudes in. And they're inmates doing the work of the warden to clean out the cell of all of Joe Testa's stuff. And Johnny won't let them in. And they threaten him. And from my memory, the way Johnny put it to me was, I told him, you three boys can whip me, but one of you is going to get hurt. Which one of us is going to be? And stood him down. And they went away. And then Joe Testa gets out of solitary confinement, hears about what Johnny had done to stand up for him, and then understands that, you know, Johnny's in because he didn't rat. Then, you know, like, he gets brought into their inner circle and is, you know, trusted and, you know, I guess taken care of to a certain degree.
Right.
And that's how he ends up understanding, learning about Omerita from an Italian perspective. And it means so much to him, he gets it tattooed on his back.
Yeah. Wow. Now, Terre Haute, that was like where they sent these mafia type criminals who would get arrested. And is this the prison that had a reputation for being the gladiator pit? Where does this term come from?
Gladiator school. Yeah. Another nickname for it was the Terror Hut. Another good depiction of it I found is for fans of drug war nonfiction, there's a memoir from England called Mr. Nice, and it's not available in America. You got to get it on eBay from the UK. It might be available other ways now. It wasn't back when I was working on the book, but Mr. Nice is a memoir of an English guy who started smuggling hash into the United States through the speaker equipment of Pink Floyd's for Pink Floyd concerts. And then, you know, like, and then grew from there, like became a very sophisticated hashish importer into the United States, like would weigh down, would ship in hash in the speakers into the United States, and then had the sense to weigh down the speakers on the way out, so they weighed the same in and as out. You know, smart guy, but then gets caught as one does. And he ends up in Terre Haute, and he's got a long description about how awful of a place Terre Haute is, but it's also a fascinating story. I'm surprised Mr. Nice hasn't been made into a movie either. Like, Mr. Nice is a great story.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I was curious about that whole hash story because it's not something that it's really a part of the American smoking culture much anymore. It's pretty much a European thing. unless you know the right person, it's not very popular, especially now with concentrates.
It's just not necessary. Yeah. You know, you nailed it. It is, you know, European in nature. And it's because, you know, the cannabis is being processed into hash to make it easier to smuggle into Europe. When you're growing it domestically in the United States, there's less of a need to have to concentrate it down to make it easier to move. So there's just not as strong of a need of it. I found a new story from the 60s from the Courier Journal here in Kentucky, where there were a couple of hippies that were talking about making hash, and they learned that in Africa they used elephant dung. So they got caught at the zoo trying to get cop some elephant dung, because that's what they, like, instead of using just like cow manure. And also a good reason not to make hash if you have to put manure as a binding agent into the product. Like, you're literally stepping on it with shit. Like, don't do that.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the hash I've got was of that supply, luckily. But yeah, I'm sure they figured out another way to do that. That is interesting. I wonder what properties that the elephant manure brings that is so special. I don't know. That's interesting. I don't know anything about how to make hash other than you would sift the keef. I just assumed that it was just keef that had been pressed all together in a solid mass, but no, apparently you need manure.
I'm sure you're gonna get comments that I don't know what I'm talking about, but I swear this is what I read.
No, I don't read the comments anyways, because yeah, who knows what they're gonna say. But yeah, that's fascinating. Now, as these guys start getting arrested, and then the country's overall perspective, opinion on cannabis starts to soften quite a bit, how does this affect these guys? I mean, now they're out of prison. Are any of them involved in the, you know, legal cannabis industry at all? Is it even legal beyond the medical industry in Kentucky? Do they have medical cannabis there?
Kentucky became the 38th state to legalize medical cannabis a couple years ago. Our dispensaries will be open later this year.
Okay.
So we're just coming online to the 21st century.
But not recreational. And much not of the South is not recreational.
Although we have two border states with rec legal, okay. Illinois and Ohio.
Okay.
So it's definitely at our doorstep.
Right.
You know, the lawmakers here in Kentucky are saying, oh, it'll never be recreational. That'll never happen. It'll never be recreational, which is exactly what they said about medical 10 years ago. Mm. You know, so it's, you know, it's the last kicking and screaming of the prohibitionists is to say never, ever, 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 ever. And you know that it's just a matter of time. Mm. Because, you know, every day our position gets stronger and their position gets weaker. It's just that the holdouts get more holdoutier. Oh, but to answer your question, a couple of these guys got in on the hemp side with a hemp brand, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. I'm not sure how successful that's been for them, but there's been some, you know, some forays in it. You know, like the Kentucky medical program, like any of these places, has been, you know, it's difficult or impossible, literally unconstitutional, to protect local interests against out-of-state interests who get involved in the space. And so early interest is always dominated by out-of-state MSO, big money, big operations, which is what happened here. And that'll take time to settle. And when it settles, then there'll be some licenses that become available, and folks, second-generation folks, can definitely find an opportunity to get involved on the cannabis side. But the initial rush is just the money's too big from too many places to mess with it. Kentucky issued license in the first round by lottery through the Kentucky Lottery in a way that was meant to look random, but didn't feel random. And in the end, you know, landed in the laps of lots of out-of-state interests. So local folks who tried to get involved in the first round got burned, and that's unfortunate, but just kind of the nature of the reality of opening up a market to cannabis is just a lot of out-of-state money comes in.
Yeah. Yeah, it's happened in a ton of states. I think the exception would be like California, where those activists and kind of got involved and allowed for some of those, you know, craft type operations to have a chance. But even those, I don't know the state of it. But I remember in 2016 when I visited Colorado and it was still illegal here in most of New England, you know, there was plenty of dispensaries that were, you know, small businesses, or at least seem to be that way, have that focus and be interested in, you know, this sort of connoisseur approach. And yeah, I'm curious, you know, did any of these guys become connoisseurs of cannabis, like, or was it purely a money-making operation? Like, is this something that they've passed down to their kids, like a love of cannabis? Is it still something that kind of is in the blood of people of Marion County because of this cornbread generation?
I mean, it's definitely like part of the culture, and you know, the like writing the book to have like help folks understand and process the experience has been really helpful in helping to normalize cannabis in the community, because before it was nebulous and difficult to understand. It was, you know, part legend, part myth, part taboo subject that no one was supposed to speak of. And so by writing the book, I feel like I helped the community process all of that and make, like, put it, things in the correct context so that, like, the next generation can better understand their role in the world. And, you know, there's, you know, definitely young entrepreneurs, you know, in the Marion, Nelson County area, like, you know, like, who will make a name for themselves in the cannabis space. And some already have, you know, like, they've had to go other places to do it, you know, from the cultivation side, but they've taken their Kentucky know-how to, you know, Colorado and California and Nevada and other places, you know, showed up and knew what they were doing.
Yeah. Are there any, I know cannabis sort of grows in a sort of way in different landscapes and kind of adapts to its climate and environment. Are there any local strains or, you know, phenotypes of cannabis that Kentucky or Marion County is known for, or any sort of nicknames that people could look for if they're maybe looking on the dispensary shelves? They might see some Kentucky's finest.
I've not seen a Kentucky strain in a dispensary, but you never know, given, you know, the, you know, sort of rapid cycle of, you know, myriad strains that you see everywhere. The one unique strain that I recall that's local that had a memorable name is Pukin Red. If you see Pukin Red, it came from down there.
Really? Because that's interesting considering the Central America connections, because there's a famous strain that's not really, I don't know, I've never seen it, called Panama Red. And
right.
Who knows, maybe that got its name from a crossbreeding with that, or who knows?
I mean, they would definitely have the opportunity to have some, you know, Panama Red seeds and, right, and crossbreed them. Like, that's definitely, and you know, people like Johnny Boone were master horticulturalists. Like, there was, like, he sort of uniquely among that first generation was like the master grower, and he was always crossbreeding strains. Now, whether Pukin Red originated from him or not, I don't, you know, can't say, don't know, but it's definitely a strain that pokes up every now and then, you know, in the harvest season. You know, comes, you know, here is, you know, like October, November early, and then, you know, it gets properly cured around, you know, by Christmas. You go around for Christmas parties, folks, you know, folks have things to share.
Right on. Now, is that the gentleman that's on the cover?
That's the gentleman on the cover.
Right on. So he's still growing, it seems.
He's passed on.
Okay. Well, when he was alive after his time in prison, it seems like he still enjoyed cannabis, and or at least hemp. I don't know how much it was allowed, but that was something he brought with him to the end of his life.
Presumably. He and I lost touch with one another toward the end there, but certainly when I knew him in 2007, it was part of his life.
Right on. Well, Jim, it's a fascinating saga, and I'm sure Marion County is grateful that you're able to put all this together, and I'm grateful that you joined us to share this story. The Cornbread Mafia is fascinating. A group of people who had integrity, and yeah, it's something admirable, something American. And with that, You know, any final thoughts on the Cornbread Mafia and maybe even the best place for folks to pick up a copy of the book?
We sell copies of Cornbread Mafia at our website at cornbreadhemp.com. Most of the copies that go out, I make sure to sign. So you can get a signed copy usually at cornbreadhemp.com. And then where you can also get 5 milligram D2C THC seltzers among in THC gummies, CBD gummies.
Right on.
So we're not a full service hemp company. We do not do vapes or flower, but we make USDA certified gummies and oils and topicals, and we ship THC beverages to states where it's legal.
Right on. So I can get them right here in Connecticut?
You can get them right there in Connecticut. Right we also on. Might have some retailers in Connecticut as well in the supplement space, but you can just check out cornbreadhemp.com and you can take it from there.
How did that get started from writing the book to creating Cornbread Hemp? Did you?
My co-founder is my cousin, Eric Zipperly. He's a business guy and a marketing background and a branding genius. And we took my story and turned it into a brand. He's our CEO and I'm our communications officer. And I've been doing a lot of policy work trying to keep hemp products legal in state legislatures this year while we release THC seltzers into the world.
Right on. And now, is it grown in Kentucky?
Grown in Kentucky, yeah. Right. Outdoor, sun-grown, rain-fed Kentucky hemp.
Wow, look at that, folks. So you don't just have to daydream about the Cornbread Mafia's product. You can get a little taste of it yourself with Cornbread Hemp. Look at that. That's awesome. Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. And I'm going to share the links in the episode description. Go there, folks, now, wherever you're listening. And thank you for tuning in. Until next time, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was our conversation with James Higdon. The links are in the episode description if you want to pick up a copy of his book. And sign up on Patreon, patreon.com/MFTIC, to support the show. I need your support. You get bonus content, ad-free content. It's well worth the tiers, and you get all sorts of bonuses for signing up at the various tiers. The $5 tier is the best bang for your buck. $8 is going to get you the premium content. So go over there and sign up, and we'll catch you next episode. Until then, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now.
Broadcasting the moon matrix from the lunar surface. They want you confused like you never knew your purpose. Hopping through the portals, dismantling the machine. My family thinks I'm crazy, I can't believe what I've seen. Memories of a war, the Pleiadians and Anunnaki. Stuck within the genes of a copy of a human body. DNA fractal, the universe within me. Epiphanies of science is hoarded by the Illuminati. Puppet masters know the power of the mantra. Repeating mad lies till it has an effect on ya. Subliminal messages hijack your perception. Tricking the population with holographic projections. We see through it, and the system is unraveling. I'm astral traveling through the library of the Vatican. On a sacred journey, I embark with the squad. Forever spitting truth like Mark on the pod. Gotta know the facts, never hold back. Cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality. Looking for the answers, searching through the galaxy. You might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade. I awoke in a deep underground military base. Zero recollection of how I got to this place. Alien corpses floating in glass cylinders. Must have been extracted when they crashed into us. Animal hybrids contained in the cages. A lion with the eagle head. Monkeys with reptilian faces. Losing my mind and I'm feeling desperate. I look around the room and I see no sign of an exit. All of a sudden the wall flickers away, revealing a hangar full of spacecraft. My getaway, I run to the nearest one. See a guard, knock him out, rob him for his plasma gun. Hop in the ship, take the controls. They highly intuitive, I figure it out easily. Lift off, accelerate through a tunnel until I see the light. Fly into the sky, get flanked by six F-35s. Gotta know the facts, never hold back. Cause I ain't
getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers, searching through the galaxy. You might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.